Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The stock market is not the economy, and the economy is not the stock market. But people still, perhaps understandably, get concerned when one of these two things isn't looking too good because of the impact it could have on the other. Stock markets around the world have trillions of dollars worth of people's money invested in them and represent companies that collectively employ billions of workers. If those companies aren't doing well, then people are going to lose money in their portfolios and billions of jobs could be on the line. If people lose their jobs and don't have money to pull out of investments, then they can't spend money, which will only further hurt these companies, creating a vicious feedback loop. The health of the economy also surely impacts the companies that are listed in all of these exchanges around the world. Economic performance is normally measured using GDP, which is the total output of an economy. If the economy is not producing as much output, it's because the industries in that economy are not doing as well. An industry in most advanced economies around the world is overwhelmingly represented by companies. So, with that basic overview in mind, it makes even less sense when economists insist that these two things are separate, and even beyond that, not even particularly strongly correlated. That insistence becomes even more important when very large and influential investors make very public investments based on their predictions about the health of the economy into the future. These people didn't make lots of money by being wrong. So maybe this means that economists are mistaken and the obvious connection between the economy and these markets is true after all. If that is the case, then it's probably worthwhile understanding why more and more of these highly influential investors are betting against the US economy in particular. By most metrics, the USA, and a majority of advanced economies around the world for that matter, are experiencing an intense period of growth. And while a lot of that is just making up for the contraction caused by the global pandemic, the world is still wealthier today than it ever has been. So, who is right? Can the economy teach us what the stock market is going to do, or vice versa? If it can, what are the indicators saying right now? And finally, if it can't, how can these two markets that seem to have so much in common really be different? Finding a correlation between two sets of economic data is something that consumes the lives of people in the field of econometrics, which is using statistical methods with a knowledge of economics to provide usable information for economic decision makers. Most people with even a basic understanding of supply and demand will know that something like increasing the money supply will, all other things being equal, lead to an increase in inflation. Economists with a focus on econometrics will take that basic understanding and then collect data on things like the money supply, interest rates, the consumer price index, employment and total output to prove or disprove this relationship. Even more importantly than that, they can try to quantify these relationships so that institutions like a central bank will know that an increase in the money supply does indeed increase inflation, but they can also know by how much a 10% increase in the money supply at a 5% unemployment rate with negative 2% annual output growth is likely to increase inflation in 12 months' time. Now, of course, nobody can predict the future, least of all economists. But looking at data from the past and finding the nature and intensity of the relationship between economic goals and the economic tools that economists have at their disposal is the best they can do. Economists don't get to decide inflation, but they do get to decide interest rates and the level of money creation, just like a driver doesn't get to change how fast their car is going, but they do get to decide how hard to push down on the accelerator pedal. Other variables will stand between the desired outcome and the mechanism by which that outcome is achieved. With the example of the car, there is normally a strong correlation between how hard the accelerator pedal is pushed and how fast the car goes, but it's not perfect. Other statistically significant variables, like what gear the car is in, how much does it weigh, what kind of road is it driving on, or is it even turned on, need to be considered as well. And cautious feedback is key to making sure these results are in line with expectations. In a car, that feedback is given through the dashboard. And for an economy, that feedback is given by people using econometrics to collect and make sense of data. Compared to all that, finding the correlation between a well-documented index like the S&P 500, which tracks the 500 largest listed companies in the USA, and the GDP of the USA is incredibly easy. And of course, with something so simple, with the potential to make a lot of money, economists have run this regression many times in lots of different ways. Some regressions tried to find if there was a lag in the correlation, like if GDP fell 1 year, the stock market might fall 6 months or a year later. Some tried to find if there was a one-sided relationship. Maybe the stock market was only boosted by the economy doing well, but then was not impacted by poor economic performance. Or maybe the opposite of that was true. Any kind of relationship between these two sets of data has been studied for a long time. Ultimately, they all found the same thing, which is that there is no strong correlation between the two in the short and medium term. Year to year, the performance of the economy accounts for around 7% to 11% of the growth or contraction of the stock market, something that most statisticians would not take too much notice of. Most economic measures, like total output, are designed to tell economic decision makers what to do, whereas the value of the stock market is forward-facing and is based on investors' expectations of returns and their investing power. The most obvious example of this is what the world experienced just 2 years ago at the height of the global pandemic.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
In the USA, home to the world's largest economy and the world's largest stock markets, economic metrics were not looking good. Unemployment was still high, supply chains were in disarray, inflation was becoming a major concern, and yet stock markets around the world were breaking all-time records. A year later, when unemployment had fallen back to its long-run equilibrium, inflation was stabilising and things were available on shelves again, the S&P 500 shrunk 20% and indexes, including smaller companies, were doing even worse. Obviously, these were extreme circumstances, but those are the times when it would be most logical that these two points of data would move in unison. On an average day, there are forces that work to push the stock market and the economy in the opposite direction. Something like a high level of consumer debt could be good for companies that sell consumer goods or provide consumer credit, but it acts as a contractionary force on economic growth. But this is only in the medium to short term. To make matters more confusing, in the long term, there does seem to be a correlation between these two points of data, and that makes sense. Companies are the primary drivers of economic output, and the only way their values increase in the long run is to increase that output, which will, all other things being equal, increase the size of the economy. On the same hand, companies can only grow so large if they have customers to sell their goods and services to, so a stagnant and shrinking economy will eventually lead to a stagnant stock market, assuming that the companies that make up these stock markets can't expand their operations overseas. A clear example of this is a country like Japan. Despite being the world's third largest economy and home to a long list of globally recognised companies, its economy has been stagnant for more than 30 years, and its stock market has too. Compare that to the USA, which has had strong growth over the same time period, and the public companies that are represented in its stock markets have also grown. It's not a perfect analogy, but sometimes it's useful to think of the relationship between GDP and a country's stock market as kind of like the relationship between someone's income and the value of their home. Year to year, the value of their home might go up and down as the market moves around totally independent of their income. At the same time, if that person loses their job, the value of their home isn't immediately going to go to zero. To stretch the analogy, the price of their home might even increase as they have time to fix stuff up around the place. The comparison here being the emergency measures like lowering interest rates and bailing out companies with stimulus measures. There are also some people that make good incomes but don't really want a big expensive house. For this video, we have been looking mostly at the USA, which has by far the largest stock markets in the world. But a country like China, by comparison, has a similar-sized economy in terms of output, but a much smaller stock market because their investors prefer to put money into real estate, it's a much less attractive destination to foreign investors, and there are just fewer companies that have grown as large as the ones in the USA. In fact, the value of the market for company stocks in the USA is a bit of an outlier even when compared to other Western advanced economies around the world. Just one US company, Apple, alone, is worth more than every company listed on every stock exchange here in Australia, which is, by its own right, not a small economy at all, and it's relatively accommodating of businesses too. As we'll explore soon, the immense size of the US stock market can both be a blessing and a curse. In this analogy, it would be someone with a very high income that has purchased an extremely expensive house. Even still, over the long term, the expectation is that a higher income, or annual economic output, will lead to buying a more expensive house or having a more valuable stock market, respectively, even if the changes in these values year to year are mostly unrelated. If this still sounds confusing, don't worry. John Maynard Keynes, probably the most famous and influential economist of all time, tried to use his understanding of the business cycle to make money in the stock market and currency markets. For the first few years of trying this, he suffered considerable losses and almost bankrupted himself. Even someone as brilliant as Keynes had difficulty predicting economic cycles, and even if he did get them right, they would only have a weak correlation at best with investment markets. Later on in life, by historical accounts, he would go on to be an above-average investor, but that only happened after he did away with the strategy of being an economist trying to predict the future. Apparently they can't do that. So with that in mind, what does it mean when people talk about major investors betting against the economy? Well, it can mean a few things, and a few of those can even be the exact opposite of one another. The stock market is not the only investment market that people can use to speculate with. They can also use assets like bonds. If an investor thinks the economy is going to do poorly, they might sell short-term bonds and buy long-term bonds. Bonds are just a loan. They have a value based on the amount the loan was for, the interest rate they're paying, and the risk of the loan not being repaid. Bonds can be sold by companies that want to raise money as an alternative to selling shares or taking out a loan from a bank, or they can be sold by governments. Government bonds are usually safer than corporate bonds, especially in advanced economies where bonds are denoted in the government's own currency, because if push came to shove, they could always repay those bonds by just printing more money. Now, normally when an economy enters a downturn, the central bank will lower interest rates to try and stimulate spending. Those lower interest rates means that borrowing becomes cheaper, so people will pay less on their loans and have more money left over to spend on consumption and investment, which are the two major components of economic output. It also makes saving less rewarding, which also motivates economic participants to spend their money or invest it elsewhere to make sure it's not sitting around doing nothing. In aggregate, this should hopefully go a long way to counteracting the decline in investment and spending caused by job losses and declining confidence that comes with a downturn, which means that the economy can get back on track faster than if it was left to crash without any intervention. That's great, but it means that people who make money off interest-bearing assets are going to lose out because of the lower interest rates. The way around this is to buy long-term bonds that had their interest rates set before rates were lowered. If an old bond pays a 5% rate, then interest rates are lowered so that a new bond pays a 2% rate, then the value of the old bond will increase because it pays out more money. Say both bonds were loans for $1,000 each. The old bond would pay $50 a year and the new bond would pay $20 a year. Someone that wasn't happy making $20 a year could go to someone who had an old bond and offer to buy it for $2,000. It would still pay $50 a year in interest, but to the person that bought it, that would be an effective interest rate of 2.5%, better than what they could get by buying a new bond. The person that sold the old bond made $1,000 in profit in a short amount of time, and the person that bought it got a slightly better return overall. Win-win. Now, bond pricing is a little bit more complex than this in reality. This example assumes that the bonds never have an expiry, but the same basic principles apply. People betting against the economy can profit off this by buying bonds at a higher interest rate before they think rates will drop, and then sell them to profit if rates do actually drop. Normally, shorter period bonds are more valuable compared to their interest rates than longer term bonds because, unlike a savings account, once the money is put into a bond, it can't be taken out again until that period is up. Locking money away for 10 years is riskier than locking it away for just 1 year because whoever is buying that bond may need it back before the bond matures. Now, the only time this doesn't happen is when lots of investors think that interest rates will drop because they will then want to buy the long-term bonds where they can lock in the higher interest rates for as long as possible before rates do drop. When long-term bonds are relatively more valuable than short-term bonds, this is called an inverted yield curve, and economists and commentators get very worried about this when it happens because it's effectively people voting with their money that they think the economy will look worse in the future than it does today. In reality, speculators make wild guesses about the future all the time. If they're right, they make a profit. If they're wrong, they make a loss. That's just what they do. The yield curve is currently inverted, but that has more to do with the general expectation that interest rates will fall from where they are today because they were raised significantly higher than normal to fight off inflation. Falling interest rates would represent a return to normal rather than an emergency measure to stimulate the economy. Things like the currency appreciation of the US dollar and the euro in particular signify that most investors still have a lot of confidence in major established economies, more confidence at least than they do in a lot of the other economies around the world. If there is one concerning trend, it's that the USA, which has always had a very high ratio of company value to economic output, is now pushing this to an extreme. Historically, the collective value of all public companies in the USA has been around 80% of GDP. Today, it's more than double that, and it's approaching the all-time high again, which was previously set during the height of the pandemic. These two factors may not be correlated in the short term, but long term, either the economy is going to need to grow to keep up, the value of these companies is going to need to come down, or this is going to have to become the new normal. Of course, an economist is the wrong person to make this prediction, but Warren Buffett, possibly the most influential investor of all time, has said that this is a ratio he looks at a lot, and that anything over 120% suggests that the market is overvalued. The lesson here, if nothing else, is that the economy and investment markets play by two very different sets of rules, and most people struggle to make accurate predictions in either, let alone both, at the same time. Thanks for watching, mate. Bye.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.